from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today, we'll learn about an indigenous-led movement to help protect the sturgeon returning to Milwaukee's waterways. Then we'll learn how Milwaukee Film is embracing camp for Pride Month.
It is all over the place in terms of films. Brokeback Mountain, a very powerful, poignant film, and then Grease 2 is also in the lineup. Like, we're just getting people together. Let's revisit some of these films and talk about them and have a great time.
Plus, we'll head to Alice's Garden to learn how they're cultivating community and peace this summer.
You should not have to leave an urban context to find peace and joy. And we don't want people to have to go away to find those moments or hours or days of peace.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. The Sturgeon Protectors is an indigenous-led organization that's working to educate Milwaukee residents about the importance of sturgeon. The ancient fish has been making its way back to Milwaukee waterways. Their return is seen as a story of endurance, survival, and resilience. Mark Denning and Siobhan Marks are organizers of the Sturgeon Protectors Group. WUWM's Eric Vaughn fellow Maria Peralta Arellano spoke with them about their efforts.
Winnebuju, Wendoway, Maganaduk, Nottoway, Benazi, Indigenous, Namein Dodem, Anishinaabe, and Dow, Neopen, and Donjaba. My name is Mark Denning. I live right here in Muskego, Wisconsin.
Buju, Ziguanodonens, Indigenous, Migizi, and Dodem. Odawa Zayaganin Ojibwe, Anishinaabe Kwaitin Bao, Menominee Zayaganin Ndojiba, Neju Medeo. I just told you my Anishinaabe name, Ziguanodonens, and then I'm Eagle Clan. I'm a lineal descendant of the Lakutere Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. My family was originally from Rice Lake, and that's in Wisconsin, not the one in Minnesota, and that I am second degree Medeo.
Beautiful. Thank you for that introduction. Just to start, could you guys tell me about the creation of the Sturgeon Protectors, what your mission is, and how you guys go about achieving it?
Mark here. I'll handle that one. The idea of the Sturgeon Protectors really started with other areas around the state of Wisconsin and Michigan. There's other states that have them. And Sturgeon Protectors are usually a local group of people who are interested in the preservation of the fish. They are a very beautiful fish. They're also my clan. And what caused my interest in helping create a Sturgeon Protector group here in Milwaukee was that sturgeon were and have been returned to Milwaukee waters. They just returned only a few years ago after, I believe it's been over 140 years of absence. And that's been through the efforts of the Department of Natural Resources here in Wisconsin and a lot of citizens who are interested in restoring the fish to its natural habitats here in Southeast Wisconsin. So it takes a while for sturgeon to mature. So when the eggs and the silt are put together and we have the little sturgeon and they're raised in their tanks. They're released into, at least in this area, the Milwaukee River. And so they go into that river that flows into Lake Michigan. And we didn't know if we would see them because they don't come back right away. They're out doing what sturgeon do, swimming and living their life and getting their sense of the world. But they do return after about 15 to 20 years, and we're in that return cycle right now. So these fish that were planted so many years ago have now come back. The Sturgeon Protector Formation is about just doing what the name suggests, is to protect sturgeon. So many of our fishermen in the Milwaukee area have not seen sturgeon. They don't know what they look like. They might run into them and think, what an odd fish, and want to take one home or try and figure it out. And the idea is first, of course, preservation through education and to get these fishermen and people who walk the river to be able to look for them, because we believe that to know something is to get to love that something. And that's what's really behind us. The Sturgeon Protector motto that we have, our mission statement is, as they live, we live. And I think it's an outstanding organization and a really great example of citizen scientists and protectors coming together to protect a resource that's returned to our waters.
So, Mark, you had mentioned that you are Sturgeon Clan, and then Siobhan, of course, you are a part of the Sturgeon Protectors. So, individually, what does the Sturgeon mean for you guys?
For me, my first introduction into this idea of the Sturgeon Clan came to me through the medicine lodge, our Madewin Three Fires medicine lodge in particular. And that was founded by our grand chief, our late grand chief, whose name was Eddie Benton Benet. He was an amazing guy, one of the founders of the American Indian Movement. And it was during a ceremony that he stopped the ceremony. And this ceremony, Madewin, sorry, is it means like the way of the heart. So we're in ceremony. He stops the ceremony. He asks everybody for a moment of their time, and he says, "I have something." And he comes towards me and says, "I'm going to give you a name," as he's walking towards me, and I'm going to give you a clan. So I already have these things in my life because I'm enrolled in the Oneida Tribe of Indians. I was also born in Menominee. I am descended from six different tribes, and I was fortunate enough to have a lot of these kinds of things in my life. But the particular discipline and belief of Madewin was something that has been in my family for years. But that line was of knowledge and participation was cut during the boarding school era. My mom was the first one to return back to the medicine lodge, and then I followed her. So that's what led me to being there. And in halting the ceremonies, he gave me a name, and he also gave me the clan, the Sturgeon Clan. And with that comes responsibilities. One of those is essentially to be like a teacher. Someone who guides, someone who speaks. And that helped lead to this native-led organization of Sturgeon Protectors. So for me, that Sturgeon Clan in a special moment is reflective of the story of Native American people in Milwaukee. And it's about survival. It's about being expunged from our native lands and our native waters and then coming back.
I would also like to offer a few words about our sturgeon, what they mean to me. I'm not Sturgeon Clan. I'm Eagle, Miggy Z Clan. And so I love to tease my partner, Mark, find photos where we have eagles catching a fish. I haven't found one catching a sturgeon yet, but I'd love to show him pictures and tease him a bit. But the sturgeon are incredible. They are one of our very oldest relatives, often referred to as the ancient ones. Times of the dinosaurs have survived. And in our creation story, as in other creation stories that have flood stories, we have a flood story. And it is said that only two survived. But the two that survived were the dragonfly and the sturgeon. And so, in many of our tribal communities, even out west, especially, I noticed the dragonfly symbol is a very strong spiritual symbol. And the sturgeon is that great reminder to us of that time. Also, in our teachings, our sturgeon, as other fish, they're stargazers. They're astronomers before modern science came up with the term astronomy, paid attention to the stars, navigate by the stars. But what's amazing about the sturgeon is they also listen. They listen to the thunder beings that come in spring. And make the sound, talking about thunder, but to us, those are thunder beings, make sounding out that it's time. And that sets so many things into motion, including for our sturgeon. They know it is now time to make their way, make their journey through the rivers, lakes, and streams to their traditional spawning grounds. And again, absurd humanness, we've built dams and we've prevented our sturgeon from getting home to their home. My auntie Orlan often tears up, and she'll share this story again and again because it's worth saying that to be in Shawano and to see that dam that's there and see the sturgeon coming, and they keep trying, they keep trying, and they keep trying, and they beat so hard against the water and the stones, they bloody the noses trying to get past that dam and back home so where they can spawn and that life can start anew. So I see that determination again of our people that we aren't supposed to be here. We were supposed to be exterminated, and through great hardship, we remain still. Stronger, I would like to say, wiser, I am hoping, as we pick up those stories, carry our teachings forward, and combine them with all of the things that modern technology can help us with, but never forgetting who we are and where we came from. And the last thing I'll say is, because every time I see them, I'm so reminded, but when you see those tiny, tiny little inch-long baby sturgeon, if you ever get a chance to really look at them up close, they carry all the correct characteristics of an adult sturgeon. And so they're just exquisite. Every little bump on them and every little filigree that remains, and they continue to grow and grow, and hopefully we'll get to live that long, full life, just as we should be able to do that. But I find them remarkable. They're reminders, again, of beginning of our world, of our creation, and who we're supposed to be as Anishinaabe.
Thank you guys. And lastly, I want to ask, what do you guys think that we as community members could learn from Sturgeon?
I'll try that one. For one of the things that I think is certainly a two-part answer. One is our own history as human beings. There was a time when we were as Native people here amongst ourselves. And it was at that time when birds were in such number that they covered the sky as clouds, when sturgeon were in the water to such numbers, when explorers came through during the time of contact, they would write that it was as if you could walk across their backs. And there is a story, again, that I had mentioned early of survival. And to me, that's especially so important in this era of self-awareness, of mental health awareness, because there's so many of us that struggle with thoughts of and challenges in our life, that it's good to have inspiration out there. And the story of sturgeon in Milwaukee is an inspiring story. It's the story of not just the sturgeon's determination to be who they are, but also the determination of people, not just Indian people, but conservationists and Milwaukeeans themselves, who wanted to return to see a return of this great being. And that saying that we have that says in Sturgeon Protectors, as they live, we live, is authentic. It's very, in a deep sense, meaningful to each of us. Because when our sturgeon return home, what kind of home will they return to? Many of us as human beings are challenged with that task, either mentally, spiritually, physically, is that idea of returning home if our homes were safe places, because it's a safe place to us. And when sturgeon return, what kind of place will they return to? In Milwaukee, and our waters should be the safest of places, the kindest of places for these fish, because they've gone through so much. And the second part will be much shorter of this answer, is that one of the things that Siobhan had shared was the noise of our thunder beings above, of, we think about and see lightning. Well, of course, there's thunder. When these fish come together, the noise that they make underwater is almost exactly the same as the thunder we hear in the sky. That connecting point of what is here and above is a great reminder of the connection we have to not just a part of our world, but all parts of our world. And it speaks to the responsibility we have to it. So that's what it means for me, is that idea of surviving, that idea of being safe, and that idea of connection to our natural world.
So I think, to me, what we can learn is the powerfulness of hope and resilience, and that it it isn't too late. I see that in the incredible effort that's been happening in our rivers, especially here in Milwaukee with the Milwaukee River Keepers. Incredible work that's been done largely by our allies, not by Native people. We're very happy to come in and do our part. But just to see that hope and belief in hope, and to see the resilience played out right before us. Even during COVID, when things shut down for the couple of weeks, so Mark and I live very close to Little Muskego Lake, and we would walk every day and go and do a ceremony by the water. And to see how quickly the lake reclaimed its natural way. We saw this little beaver with a limb in its mouth swimming along in the water, and I haven't seen that in the 30 years I've lived there. So we have the power to change the world in a good way. We just need enough of us willing to do that. And our sturgeon is a great reminder, because they've been here since the very beginning, that ancient one, and is still here reminding us that we can still make things better.
Mark Denning and Siobhan Marks are part of the Sturgeon Protectors Group in Milwaukee. They spoke with WUWM Eric Von Fellow, Maria Peralta Arellano. And did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. Coming up, we'll hear about the summer programs happening at Alice's Garden. But first, we're going to summer camp, indoors at the movies. Find out more coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Summertime is always big for new releases at the box office, but Pride Month programming at Milwaukee Film is leaning into some new-to-you films that are cult classics or queer cinema milestones. Summer Camp nods to the loud, the proud, and the unapologetically dramatic. Everything is covered. Whether in sequins for showgirls or copious amounts of fake blood for sleepaway camp, there's a wide variety of films to experience what camp means to you. To learn more, Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski spoke with Jack Feria, the genre queer programmer at Milwaukee Film.
First, let's talk about camp and the clutches it can have on audiences. What did camp mean to you when you were programming this lineup?
Camp is about having fun. Camp is over the top, extravagant. And I guess it also means throwing in Oscar-winning Brokeback Mountain and Moonrise Kingdom. We kind of thought that even just with the program as itself, just not taking itself too seriously, was a lot about the general theme of just having a fun time at the movies.
Well, and I like that it's also like a fun twist on Pride programming, because a lot of campy films are long celebrated, even if they lean into like cheesy or bad. Like sometimes that just makes them last even longer in the canon.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. And you'll see that all across the programming of this year's summer camp. Like it is all over the place in terms of films. Like I mentioned, Brokeback Mountain, of like a very powerful, poignant film. And then Grease 2 is also in the lineup. Like, we're just getting people together. Let's revisit some of these films and talk about them and have a great time.
Yeah, so if people need reminding, let's dive back into Grease 2. I admit, all I remember is, like, the scene of the song in the bunker, and that's it. I don't remember anything else about the movie. So why is this one of your favorites?
I love Grease 2 so much. It is the superior Grease. If you disagree, you haven't seen it. You haven't seen it. Grease 2 moves us from the 50s, where the original Grease took place. It takes us to the 1960s. It's still the T-Birds. It's still the Pink Ladies. But the roles from the original film are kind of swapped. For this one, we have Michelle Pfeiffer as the sort of Danny Zuko character, the John Travolta role. And then this incredibly handsome man from England as our Olivia Newton-John. And so it's switched. The songs are just ridiculous and over the top. Like you mentioned the song from the bunker called Let's Do It for Our Country. What? There's a whole sequence in a bowling alley. Tab Hunter, who was a movie star in the 1960s, who shows up in the program later on, he plays a science teacher and sings a song about plant reproduction. And that's a whole 5-minute sequence. People are going to be laughing, I hope applauding after each number, or singing along. If you know the song Segrees 2, sing along.
Make it another event like Rocky Horror. Is that your goal? You're just
Oh my
slowly
gosh,
feeding
I would
this into
love that.
the.
Yes, absolutely.
All right, well, to go away from Grease 2, there's a plethora of options here, but up next, we'll talk about Whatever Happened to Baby Jane.
Man, Whatever Happened to Baby Jane was one of those movies I saw as a kid that I'm like, I'm not sure I understand what's going on, but I just love the energy and what is happening with these characters. I think that's a great thing too about camp is that they're usually about people that are broken or just kind of exaggerated emotions. And that's what you get with Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. It's two of the greatest actors that we've ever had on the screen, Bette Davis and Joan Crawford. And it's one of those films where what's happening in the story is just as what's interesting as what's happened behind the scenes. So one of those that there's a number of books and shows you can watch about the making of this movie, but get the context, come into the theater and see Whatever Happened to Baby Jane.
Well, an honorable mention along that theme is Death Becomes Her, which you're also showing, but another theme of fading actress trying to hold on to the clutches of fame.
Yeah, and one of those that I think people have seen maybe on TV, or they've seen at least on their couch dozens and dozens of times with their friends. But there's nothing like being in a theater of like 150 people, all just cackling as Meryl Streep tumbles down the stairs, or Goldie Hawn reveals a hole in the middle of her stomach because Meryl Streep has shot her. It's just a really wonderful time. I mean, come on now. I mean, so many of these films that are in summer camp have gone on to become musicals. Like Death Becomes Her is a musical on Broadway right now, up for a bunch of Tonys next Sunday. It's also heightened, it's also fun.
Yes, and moving on to Showgirls. This is a famous, infamous film, whatever you want to call it. It definitely has a place in the movie canon.
Yes, it is a notorious film. I think if you are a fan of RuPaul's Drag Race, and you've never seen Showgirls, you really should see it because you will find out that so many lines that either Ru says or some of the queens say come from this movie. Showgirls is a classic. I think one of the parts of camp is that something is very misunderstood. And this film has really been embraced by the people that love it. And I think this will be the rowdiest of the screenings for summer camp.
Now that's a good incentive to go is a rowdy crowd. I love that, especially for older films, if some people know it or don't even know it. But for people out there, maybe especially younger listeners who've never seen Showgirls, never heard of it, what's kind of the central plot of it?
Oh, so Nomi Malone, who is played by Saved by the Bell's Elizabeth Berkley. Remember, this is the 90s. She plays Nomi Malone, who is a wannabe showgirl who moves to Las Vegas from different places and gets kind of trapped in the glitz and the glamour of Las Vegas and the backstage politics and throwing beads to trample over someone who you want the part from. It is just a ridiculous movie that you will never guess what the next scene is going to be. It's wild. I think it's worth mentioning the movie is NC-17, and this really earns that rating. It is out there. It is bold. Definitely not one to bring your grandma to. But if you want to, we have Moonrise Kingdom as part of the program as well. We have something for all ages, but Showgirls is for our rowdiest folks.
Another fun showing that has a little bit of rowdy interaction with scratch and sniff cards. When I heard this announcement, I was like intrigued. It was like, oh, there's scratch and sniff cards to go with this showing. It's Polyester in Odorama. What is
Yeah.
this film?
John Waters, growing up, was a big fan of William Castle, who was this horror film director in the 50s and 60s who made all of these gimmicky movies. So they would be stuff like, if you die from fright, we'll give you $1,000 to a beneficiary, or you have these not 3D glasses, but glasses that can show you ghosts or don't show you ghosts. All these little things that he would do to kind of do flourishes on films and make them events. So John Waters decided to adopt that with Odorama. So everyone that attends will get a scratch and sniff card. And when prompted on the screen, you'll scratch the corresponding number and you will get to smell a John Waters movie. It is an experience like no other. You can't get these cards on the DVD library thing, so you can only get it in the theater. And the last time that I saw this film was at the Milwaukee LGBT Film and Video Festival. Shout out to Carl Bogner for programming that. It was an amazing screening and so special to be in a room with 150 people as we're all just giddy and giggly about scratching, smelling. You get to hear the different reactions. You get to experience a John Waters movie that stars Divine and Tab Hunter.
Amazing. And I want to give a quick shout out to one film, Debs. And I'm just going to read the poster line and then we can move on because I feel like this just summarizes a whole category of camp movies. Crime fighting hotties with killer bodies. I feel like there's dozens of movies that fall into that category, but Debs is a classic.
Speaking of dozens, we had about like 40 to 45 films that were on the list of what we first thought would be this first edition of Summer Camp. So we can have many more years of Summer Camp to come.
Absolutely. And to really like end on a camp note, there is a film specifically called Sleepaway Camp, and I feel like it's a great tie-in because camp often involves horror.
Doesn't love a camp slasher. And this is one of the most notorious, whether for controversial reasons or just because of how ridiculous it is. This is a film that I distinctly remember in high school watching at sleepovers and being like, how did this movie get made? This is wild what I'm seeing and what I'm hearing. In terms of what you're seeing, it's the 1980s and you have like ridiculous short shorts. And at the same time, those characters are, because it's the 1980s and they're teenagers, are saying over the top, like homophobic things that just circle around and make you go, what is going on? Who are these people saying these things? But they get their comeuppance.
Truly do. You know, what's great about camp is like you can lean into the cringe, you can laugh at it, you can criticize it, but at the end of the day, I imagine the goal with these films is like it's going to be a fun experience whether you've seen these films or not.
Absolutely. It's to get people together and see films, like I mentioned earlier, that you've maybe seen on your couch a dozen times, or you've heard your friends talk about, but you get to watch it in like the greatest place to watch movies in the whole world, the Oriental Theater. I think just the Oriental Theater as a venue for this, I mean, it's ornate and it's gorgeous, but it is over the top. It's the perfect place to have a summer camp series.
Well, Jack, I want to thank you so much for joining me to give a little preview for some of the programming offered this month.
Thank you so much. See you at the movies. And I turn around like, oh my
God, like, I'm your number one fan. Jack Feria is the genre queer and shorts programmer at Milwaukee Film. They joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to talk about the summer camp series for June. You can find the full listing of films at WUWM.com. Milwaukee Film is a financial contributor to WUWM. So kiss the bad news. I'm coming for everyone, and I'm coming on strong. New hair and new shoes. Just like some of the films in the summer camp lineup, sometimes you want to watch a movie because it's so bad, it's actually good. It could just be a bad film, but it could also fit into the genre of trash cinema. Films that may seem trashy on the surface can actually have historical, societal, and cultural significance. In fact, UW-Milwaukee Director of Film Studies Jocelyn Sapaniak-Galise has a whole class dedicated to the genre. She says that trash films push boundaries, embrace shock value, and take on the taboo. to help us understand what makes a movie trash cinema. Sapaniak Galise joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski.
We think about trash typically as being something low budget, something that looks a little amateurish, something that doesn't quite fit into standard mainstream approaches to film. The way that I like to think about trash cinema is that it's a little bit tasteless. So it's something that sort of pushes the boundaries of good taste and makes us question whether we even should be watching it, or perhaps most saliently, tell anybody that we watched it at all.
So this is something I was just thinking about. Do you think there's a difference between a B movie and trash cinema?
I do. And part of that, I think, would be about this notion of taste. So when I talk about trash cinema, I'm always actually secretly providing some kind of a philosophical approach to how we think about taste cultures and how taste is not something natural. Right? Like the thing that you like, you don't just like it because you like it. You like it because you're educated in a certain way, because you're in a certain class, often a certain race, even a certain gender, a certain nationality, right? So our tastes are shaped by all these different ideologies and experiences that we have. Therefore, a B movie, that's not always really the appropriate parameters of trash, because we can look at something like Showgirls, which is not a B movie. There was actually a significant amount of budget invested in that film, but that is wholeheartedly trash. And it's because it's so much about what are the boundaries of good taste and what are also the boundaries of vulgarity and what's appropriate on screen.
Yeah, so to dive into that a little bit more, as you say, one big component of trash cinema is pushing those boundaries in a distasteful but, you know, important way sometimes as well. So you mentioned vulgarity. What other kind of boundaries are we talking about when it comes to trash cinema?
Vulgarity is a really easy one to point to, right? Like trash cinema is often kind of obscene, right? It's something that that we really don't, you know, we don't want children to watch it. We don't want like anybody who's in like a proper sophisticated kind of art situation to watch it. But it's not just vulgarity, right? You're right. In fact, and this is really important for thinking about trash, because trash operates outside mainstream boundaries and outside respectability, it can also take on certain elements of things that maybe don't seem like they would be entirely socially appropriate at the time, such as issues around queerness. So I think in particular about Ed Wood Jr.'s film, Glenn or Glenda, which is released in 1953. And that film, which is, it's really amateurish, it's really low budget, it's really kind of only halfway narrative, but it takes on issues of being trans and the story of Christine Jorgensen, who was a really well-known trans celebrity in the 1950s, and really kind of excavates what that experience is like, which is extremely rare for a film in 1953. So even though that's not a super vulgar movie, even though, you know, it's a low budget, we wouldn't quite put it as a B movie because it's more independent, it operates outside the boundaries of the mainstream and thus can make us think about certain social issues that also exist outside of the mainstream.
One thing that trash cinema does give us that benefits what we may consider, depending on your test, like, you know, the golden standard of cinema, the ones in the canon, the AFI 100 list, all this good stuff, is the role of tropes. And you say without trashy cinema and the tropes that come with it, we wouldn't have these big, successful, well-regarded movies of today. Can you touch upon that?
Sure. What seems trashy at any moment in time is what operates outside the borders of propriety, right? Like what polite society feels okay talking about or okay discussing. And those borders are constantly shifting, right? Mm-hmm. We're constantly pushing against what is socially appropriate to discuss, but also what is stylistically or aesthetically appropriate to show. So I think about something like Herschel Gordon Lewis's films. He made a lot of, he's kind of like the king of splatter films. He made films like Blood Feast in the early 1960s, which is just, I mean, it's just gore. It's just like pure gore. That's it. It's just gore. There's really nothing else going on. It's it's just like a kind of celebration of like how much gore can we throw at the screen. If Herschel Gordon Lewis hadn't done that, we then wouldn't have additional kind of approaches to gory movies that are things like Night of the Living Dead at the end of the 1960s, which at this point is a totally canonical film, right? That is totally canonical. But without Herschel Gordon Lewis's super amateurish, super out there outre approach to filmmaking, that movie really wouldn't have been possible.
I'd love to talk about how people see trash film or once saw trash film. You know, so we're ranging from 1950s before up to the 90s today. You know, what's its place in small movie theaters? What was the start of it? Was it like an underground scene? You know, ultimately, can you explain the genesis before today where we can simply search and see if we can stream it somewhere or a random trash thing is uploaded to YouTube in a channel dedicated to trash cinema?
Yeah. Wow. Okay. So that's a huge question because, but it's also a question I'm delighted by because I am an exhibition historian and that's my specialization. So I often look at the roots of trash cinema in, well, about the very early 1930s, although we can really locate it a bit earlier than that too. But the early 1930s is when exploitation cinema becomes something really, really popular. The term exploitation does not actually come from people being exploited or ideas or you know, social mores being exploited. It actually comes, our best guess is that it comes from the kind of advertising that was used for this particular kind of film. And that kind of advertising is also based on a kind of Carnival Barker approach, right? Mm-hmm. Like somebody who's like, come in one and all, see this crazy sideshow and check out what's happening. An exploitation film would show in theaters that were like on the wrong side of the tracks sometimes, right? Like things that were not quite the fancy downtown theaters. Or sometimes exploitation cinema would be shown in a process called four-walling, and that would be renting out some kind of a theatrical space that was really underused, showing your film really quickly, and then kind of taking off after the weekend of showing. So there's a really long legacy of showing trashy, unacceptable, kind of edgy films in places that typical members of polite society would not necessarily go. So then if we skip forward a bit into the 1970s in particular, we get wonderful examples of midnight screenings. And this is, I think, what we all think about now as like this golden era of trash cinema, which is the 1970s. Of course, trashy cinemas would show at drive-ins, but they would also show at theaters like the Elgin, which is one of my very favorite theaters. It was in New York, and the Elgin showed both art house movies and then would show trashy kind of out there movies at midnight. So there's a great tradition of showing trash in moments where you wouldn't see a kind of normal, acceptable film. And that adds to the cachet of seeing a trash movie.
So even if some movies are made in bad taste and, of course, push boundaries or sometimes are just really awful, what's the cultural significance and societal significance of this genre?
Oh, wow. There is so much significance in trash that we've been kind of unwilling to recognize for so long because we're so obsessed with markers of quality, right? Mm-hmm. And so much of that has to do with film and mass media in general's excision from the realm of high art for so long, right? I mean, that's not true anymore, but for decades and decades, film struggled to be a part of that kind of like high art hierarchy. Trash manages to disrupt that hierarchy, right? It says that maybe what is high art is not the only thing that's of value. In fact, we can find so many diamonds in this dirt of trash cinema. And when we sift through it, we can discover so much more about what's actually happening in society writ large, what ideologies are really being talked about, what people are afraid of, what people are maybe titillated by. There's all sorts of things that we can sort of parse out when we start really looking at how trash functions. And that is true for a lot of trash cinema. It's why it's so important to look to it and begin to understand it, because we can see so many more elements there that couldn't be addressed in more standard normal film.
Certainly a lot to dig into, but Jocelyn, I want to thank you so much for sharing some of it with me today.
Yeah, thank you.
Jocelyn Sapaniak-Galise is an associate professor of English and the director of film studies at UW-Milwaukee. She spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in 2023. We've got a new season of Bubbler Talk going, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. Coming up, we'll head to Alice's Garden Urban Farm for the latest edition of Dig In. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. As anyone with allergies will tell you, Milwaukee is a bloom. And as flowers and animals emerge from the cold winter season, people are also looking to get out into the community. The weather, alongside a tense political climate, has made many Milwaukeeans more interested in connecting with others. That's good news for Venus Williams, the executive director of Alice's Garden and the Fondy Food Center. The garden and the center have packed schedules this summer, full of opportunities to get outside and build new relationships. I joined Venus at the garden for this month's Dig In. Well, Venus, it is a cloudy but beautiful day to be in the garden.
It is an incredible day to be at Alice's Garden Urban Farm, and I am so happy to be here and to welcome you home, as we always say when people come to this space.
Now, one of the things we talked about a little while back, just after the election, I believe, was about creating spaces, but also existing in the spaces we've created. You had a beautiful post that really blew up online that talked all about creating community. And right now we're here in community.
Indeed. The growing season, the programming season, the cultivation of people and plants has begun here at Alice's Garden Urban Farm. And we are so excited about being a sacred space, a place where people can come and get to know themselves better, nature better, and one another. And we have an incredible palette of things going on during this 2025 year for people to dig in.
Very apt.
Yes, yes, yes.
So honestly, just looking around, the garden has already changed so much in the month since I've been here. But of course, as you say, there is a lot to look forward to this summer here at the garden and at a variety of the community spaces that you're a part of.
Yes. So we really have been extremely intentional this year, knowing that people are saying we need more spaces to gather. We're the events that are going to really be bridge building events and truth telling and naming events. Here at Alice's Garden, that's what it's always been about. And even at the Fondy Farmers Market, which has already begun, that I'm also blessed to be able to help grow. When people come together, whether they're purchasing fresh food or eating locally made cupcakes from the vendor or purchasing duck eggs, which are very popular right now at the Fondy Farmers Market, or if people come here and they get to harvest the apple mint, the holy basil, all the things that are growing, there is just something magical that happens when food and plants and nature is present and doing what it needs to do. You know, when you talk about growing food and cultivating people and doing it together, it is about diversity. The diversity of what a gardener here at Alice's Garden or at the Fondy Farm Project on the Mequon Nature Preserve, what we are planting, but it's also about what we attract. And it's the same thing when it comes to programming. We plan programming to attract joy, right? To bring in wellness, to say to people, come on to this piece of land and see what lies inside, not just inside of the soil and the ground, but inside of you. So whether we are talking about a NIA class that is a dance movement class that will happen here every Tuesday at 7:15 p.m., dancing with people who you may not have known before you have come through these gates. Whether we're talking about doing some cooking in the Healthy Moms, Healthy Kids program on Monday mornings and Tuesday evenings, or if you're just coming to sit, you know, people just come in here to sit and to enjoy and listen to nature. This morning as I came in and I was the first one through through the gate, and all of the creatures greeted me, and they told me, welcome home. I was almost in tears, because here we are in an urban context, and if you close your eyes, you will think you're out in the forest somewhere.
One of the amazing things I always think about Alice's garden is it does feel like this kind of oasis, but you do also hear the city, and I think there's something kind of beautiful about that. Right now we're hearing a lawnmower going, you'll hear cars going, and there's something really beautiful about being able to be one with nature and experience that, but also have the city as this kind of backtrack.
You should not have to leave an urban context to find peace and joy, and we don't want people to have to go away to find those moments or hours or days of peace. There are places like Alice's Garden where you can come in, bring all of you in, all of your complicated layers of humanity, but learn from others and from food and from the other creatures that live here about what it means to live together and to thrive together.
It's funny because my husband and I have started bird watching more. I am not very good at seeing birds, I have learned pretty quickly, but I'm very good at hearing them.
Oh.
And so mostly I could hear when there's different types of birds around us, and listening to the garden, you can, of course, we're right now near a lawnmower, but inside of the space you can still hear birds, and you can still hear the different hums of the insects that are here.
Even though I know that I share this space with them, when I see the first monarch, which happened yesterday for me, I'm like a little kid, so giddy. When I see the first finch, when I see, okay, I get happy about all birds except that red-winged blackbird. However, they are plentiful here and have been quite polite. But it does remind me, even that red-winged blackbird, that I am called to coexist with creatures that are different than I am and who may cause me harm if I go near that red-winged blackbird's nest on the ground. But in this space, and in so many spaces in Milwaukee, we are called to learn how not to just tolerate each other, but to appreciate the diversity that we bring to the city. And again, I think food teaches us that as well. We will have our first garden potluck in a couple of weeks, and the food that will be present representing all of the cultures, all of the ethnicities, all of the humanity that exists in this space. It's one of my favorite events of the year.
Well, and that's one of the big questions I have as you're looking forward to the summer itself. What are you most excited about?
I'm most excited about literally just bringing people together. You know, I'm most excited. I'm always surprised still, again, when I plan something and people show up. I don't know why, but when people start coming through that gate, whether it's for the first time or whether they are here every week, it just makes me appreciate my own calling. Like you were brought to this city to help cultivate all that is good in both its people, its soil, and its neighborhoods. And so I'm just really, it's not even complicated. I'm just excited about bringing people together. It's that simple for me.
Now, as you are looking toward the summer, what have you been reading?
So I am about to embark on The Seven Circles, Indigenous Teachings for Living Well, and the whole city of Milwaukee can embark on this with us, because it is the book that we are going to journey with every Wednesday morning this summer, 9:30 a.m., right here under this pavilion.
All right.
Well, Venus, thank you as always for inviting me to the garden. And I'm looking forward to a summer full of community.
Thank you. So am I. See you in the garden.
Venus Williams is the executive director of Alice's Garden and the Fondy Food Center. She joins us regularly for a series we call Dig In. You can find our previous conversations at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll kick off a new season of Bubbler Talk with a story about what seems to be a bridge to nowhere in Milwaukee's McKinley Park. Thanks so much for joining us right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.